Hey guys, welcome back. This episode is going to be a talk that I had with Logan, who is a co-owner of Aligned Incentives, which is one of the biggest gift card reselling groups out there. I do kind of like this format of talking with someone else on the show, although this was my first time doing this, so there is a lot of room for improvement. So yeah, still an open invitation if anyone else wants to come on. I know I did have a lot of people asking for a tax professional to come on the podcast. For that one, I would just say be careful what you wish for. I'm not sure if people are going to be too happy about what we say for that, but I do have some leads on that and am working on trying to find someone. So hopefully that materializes. So stay tuned for that. And for now, let's get into it.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, good. Yeah, thanks for coming on. So to get started, why don't you just kind of give an overview about how you got into churning and how Aligned Incentives was started?
My wife, first meeting like almost a decade ago, sent me a link to the Rolling Stone article about Lucky from 1 mile at a time, and seemed pretty easy to earn points, so I started doing that. And then obviously I needed ways to spend more money to hit all my sign-up bonuses. And so then I found Gift Card Wiki, I believe, which, you know, they're a competitor of ours now. And I was selling there, and then I was also selling to the plastic merchant. And then the plastic merchant went bankrupt, and I lost money there, as did a bunch of other people. So I'm in Austin, Texas, and most of the founders of the company, there's six of us, were all there in Austin, and we were all in a meetup group, and a bunch of us lost money to the plastic merchant, and we decided that we could do our own thing. And Jim, one of my business partners, he basically threw up a sheet and was like, you know, put your name on the sheet if you want to start a company. And several of us did. And we threw in some money, and you know, I'm an attorney. I formed it and all that, and we started going. So like that's how we got started.
Okay, cool. So the initial investment, where did that go towards? Did that go to the website or just as like some cash reserves?
Well, so when the site started, we only sold our own gift cards. So like if you sell on Raise, your volume determines your commission. And so our thought was like, well, we all know that we buy a lot of HEB deals because we all live in Austin. So, you know, we'll just make a Raise account and everyone will just like get the money from their own sales. And the $1,500 was basically just in case someone had a bunch of debits and skipped town, more or less. It was kind of just like insurance money. And then a couple of years later, we started taking cards from other people with like a Google Sheet, as some folks do, with the intention being that if we could make money doing that, then we would spend the money to develop a website. And then in, I think, 2020, we started developing the website. And that cost considerably more than $1,500. That was like cost all of the money that we had made up to that point, essentially.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, you guys have probably one of the best websites. And like you said, a lot of people just operate with a Google Sheet and that's it. So it is definitely nice to have that interface. And so I'm curious, with all these co-owners, how are you guys able to split the responsibilities?
I work on it full time. So people that are like in our Telegram see me the most. And then Jim works on it full time. And then we have a couple guys that work on it part time. And then we have a couple guys that don't really work on it at all.
Okay. So did you like quit your job to do this full time then?
Yeah, I quit my job about 2 years ago, I guess. I was an attorney. I wrote contracts for the state of Texas and quit that a couple of years ago.
Okay. And do you still like churn pretty heavily as far as like your own churning?
Yeah. Well, so I listen to the podcast, and so I hear the stuff that you do with buyer groups, like with physical merchandise, and I'm definitely not on that level. You post some pretty impressive monthly profits from doing that. I'm not there yet. But yeah, I mean, I've still got, you know, I've opened a couple carts in the last month. Yeah, I mean, I'm still traveling. One of the advantages when you own the company is there will be like two or three deals a year that are functionally unlimited. And so obviously we just do those ourselves, you know, if we can just put it all on credit cards. So that it has gotten a little easier in that way. But no, I mean, I'm still driving to HEBs and Dollar Generals and stuff whenever there's a deal.
Okay. So can I ask like what those two to three deals are?
Well, it's just something where it's unlimited. So usually like a wholesale club, or
it used to be the case, and not anymore, but like bulk at Cash Star used to be like almost unlimited. And so then if all the admin, like if all the co-owners were able to buy functionally unlimited, then, you know, that's obviously a better deal for us. And then we wouldn't necessarily post it. So, I mean, it's just stuff like that. It's just stuff where, you know, if there's no limit, we obviously all have like 40 credit cards and a $2 million credit limit, as I'm sure like probably everyone listening does. So, you know, we don't need other people to help us with those cards, essentially.
Yeah, definitely the perks of having your own gift card reselling business. Yeah, so I guess that brings me to my next question. So I was just wondering, like, where do most of the gift cards come from?
I think something like 40% of the gift cards that we handle are going to be like Kroger fuel points related, probably. And then about 60% is other stuff. And so that's going to be online deals. Like, I think you hit one of our Staples deals a few months ago. So stuff like that. And then obviously like a big chunk of the cards that we get come from in-store deals. So HEB is the local grocery store here, and they have great deals. Food City out on the West Coast. I want to say like Las Vegas area, maybe Family Fair up in Michigan. Like there's a few different grocery store chains that have really killer in-store deals that you just have to physically be present to buy the gift cards.
So yeah, like what kind of volume are your biggest sellers doing, and like from which deals would you say?
So our biggest sellers are probably people doing fuel points as well as people doing those in-store deals. Because if you think about it, like if you only do deals that you can do online from home, everybody wants those deals. These are very attractive. Everyone wants them. And they usually have a limit of, you know, somewhere between $100 and a couple thousand dollars per person. So it would just be hard to be a heavy hitter if you only did the online deals. You know, our top users are definitely, I mean, we have several people who are doing like six figures every year. Our average users are doing more like, you know, tens of thousands.
Per year.
Yeah.
Okay. So no one's doing seven figures on a year in gift cards?
I don't think so. Like in the world, yes. There are people.
So do you think maybe the reason for that is those kinds of people are just selling them themselves, like they have their own Raise account?
I think that the people doing that level of scale are probably doing Kroger. Like once you get to the point where you're getting $1 million of Home Depot gift cards yourself, I mean, first of all, like you're a full-fledged business at that point. Like you're at risk on all that inventory, and you're potentially finding people to sell directly to instead of going through us. There's a group of people that I know stopped selling to us and started selling on their own, more or less, but not really on a Raise. I think more only the Kroger type brands, you know, your Home Depot and Best Buy kind of stuff.
Okay. So like if you were to sell the gift cards yourself, like on Raise, well, I guess number one, if your volume isn't big enough, then your rates would not be as good. But then is there also like a consideration of, do you have enough capital to be able to float that much money because the payout time might be longer? Or like what would be the biggest consideration there?
Yeah, well, so a lot of this, your Best Buy, for example, you would never make money selling that on Raise. Like you have to know the right people to sell to. So that is like a network problem. But yeah, I mean, the capital requirements are pretty serious. And that's probably one of the big limiting factors. Because we buy a wide range of brands, we're able to consider our cash flow needs across a wider array of products. So like we're holding right now, we've got over $500,000 of Best Buy that we've been holding for close to a month now. And like if we needed the cash, we could sell that at a loss, but we can afford to hold it because we're moving so much other stuff. We can consider our cash flow across the entire company instead of just one or two brands. So I think a risk if you only sold Home Depot and Best Buy is that market is kind of crashed right now. And so if that was all you were selling, it would be pretty rough at the moment.
So what's the reason for the market to be crashed right now?
A big problem with those brands is Pepper. I don't know. I've seen people in the Slack talking about it, and obviously our Telegram, a lot of people are talking about it. But yeah, it's you know, the latest gift card sales app that's got a ton of venture capital, and they're giving people 10% off everything for the first 15 days at the moment. It used to be 30, and maybe it'll change again. But all that, plus on Amex Business Gold cards, it codes as computer supplies, so it earns 4x. Mm-hmm. And so with getting 10% back and with getting 4x points, all those brands are basically selling for a little bit under 90% of face value, and the market is like totally flooded. Mm-hmm. So if those were the only brands that you dealt in, and like if you were holding a bunch that you bought at Kroger, you would be in a rough position, I think.
Right. So yeah, I guess another thing I'm curious about is, so you said, so Best Buy and Home Depot, those ones are typically going to private buyers, you said?
Yeah.
So do you have any idea how they are liquidating the cards?
Well, the Best Buy, they're doing what you do. You know? Right. I mean, the Best Buy are going to people that are like buying laptops and Fire TVs and what have you. And then the Home Depot is presumably going to contractors who are buying lumber and things like that to build real stuff.
So how did you build your network of people that are buying those cards from you?
I mean, I think that it's like, if you're into churning, then like you end up in all these different chat rooms and you see people buying and selling stuff, and then you just continue asking those people where they're buying and selling stuff and things like that. And, you know, a lot of this is built on like, you know, trust and social capital and people knowing you. And so a lot of that, you know, takes time to scale up for sure.
And then I'm also curious about these fuel point buyers. So how does that whole operation work?
There's a couple ways it works. Like there's a couple different markets. So some people are selling accounts to people who are using it to buy gas for like the family car, and they're buying small amounts at a time. But there are also operations where people, they have like an agricultural sized diesel tank, like in the back of a pickup truck. And so they're getting like 600 gallons at a time, and then they're reselling the diesel. So like there's a couple different ways that the fuel points get disposed of.
Okay. So it's not like, I guess kind of I was picturing someone with like their 18 wheeler that's kind of driving into a Kroger gas station, but
I mean that, like, there is some of that, like the people that are, you know, buying a few accounts every month, like that exists, but there also exists a world of fuel reselling.
Okay, so someone is like actually filling up this huge tank of gas and then trying to go sell that, or maybe they have their own gas station and just put it back into their
touch that part of the business, but my general understanding of it is that it goes to fleets, a depot where dozens or hundreds of 18 wheelers go. They'll have their own gas pumps, and so it gets resold like bulk to those types of places.
Okay, interesting.
I hope that someone on the Slack decides to get into fuel reselling. If anyone's in Tennessee, you know, in your audience, I hope that they go buy a truck and do this.
I guess for me, like I don't really like touching, you know, the gas and stuff. It smells and it's dirt. Like I don't want to have a big tank of gas in my garage, you know.
Yeah. No, I have zero interest in doing. Yeah. I'm very happy. Like honestly, in an ideal world, we would sell software that helped people handle the fuel points, but we wouldn't even like middleman the fuel point deal, just because I don't know. I like to think that what we excel at is making great software for reselling, and I don't want to have to worry about tanks of gasoline. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and it's also that fuel points are a bit riskier in terms of like the Kroger shutting down your account.
Yeah, fuel points are riskier than some other things in that, you know, if there's a wave of shutdowns, it's possible that they up and vanish. Like we just sit in the middle on the market, right? And like we don't, with fuel especially, like we don't hold any fuel. Every fuel point that we buy, there's already a seller lined up for. And like we don't ever want to hold any fuel. The main buyer that we sell to now like insures the accounts. So if, you know, if the account is valid and if you follow all of our rules, then even if the account ends up getting shut down, then like you'll still get paid for it. But also if the account gets spent into a negative balance and they don't pay for those overages, we negotiated that deal so that there would be less risk for everyone. It's just better when you're buying gift cards and fuel points to know that you're going to get paid, right?
Right.
And so we think that's a better deal. But we do sometimes post from other buyers who don't provide that kind of insurance. It's up to our users to decide their own risk tolerance.
So do you think that these buyers are more likely to be like overdrawing a fuel point account if they don't have to pay for it? Or do you think it's always just like an accident?
I don't think that anyone is maliciously overdrawing them. I think it's just that, like, if you're given an account that you have to, you know, it's got enough points to fill up 11 35-gallon tanks of gas, I mean, you're going to be draining that account for, I don't know, at least 30 minutes. I mean, how long does it take to fill up a gas tank? All like 35 gallons. I mean, that's 2 times the size of that car. I mean, it's like 5 minutes to fill up probably. I mean, you're going to spend an hour on that account, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything malicious. I think it's just that, like, they don't keep track of how many points are left because the pump tells them how many points are left. And so there's no reason to doubt that. And then sometimes the pump is wrong.
Right. And I guess if you're counting up to 10 or 11 times, you know, I guess it could be possible to miscount in that case.
Yeah, I don't even think they're trying to count, to be honest. I mean, I think it's like, it's a bit of laziness, but I don't think it's malicious. I think it's just like, you know, we're just sending notes to a gas pump all day, so your mind is other places. That's my guess. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
So I guess, are you worried that, like, these people that are, like, accidentally overdrawing their accounts, do you think that could have an effect on the ecosystem?
Definitely. You know, like, we would prefer that that not happen. And, like, everyone, the people pumping the gas, like, out of everyone, have the most vested interest in this continuing, right? Our business does fine if fuel points are gone.
Yeah.
It's not ideal, but, like, we continue to be in a going concern, and it's fine. And indeed, we didn't take fuel points for many months after the shutdowns happened, just because we deemed it too risky, and it was, we felt a better deal for us to not participate. But the people pumping the gas, when all the shutdowns happened, they were, like, you know, trying to sell trucks. People were getting laid off. They have a vested interest in the ecosystem as a whole continuing to operate even more so than we do, which is the reason that I don't think it's malicious. Like, I'm not there at the pump while they're doing it, and I'm not, like, privy to those conversations. But I just can't fathom why, like, what would the motive be, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it would be definitely short-sighted to be doing that, for sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so you said that you are sort of open and talking, like, numbers and, like, graphs and stuff. So what is, like, your typical margin for a gift card deal?
Yeah, so when we test a deal, we are typically trying to make around 2%. And then frequently we get it a little bit wrong. And so our average ROI tends to be more like in the 1.5% range. So, like, we're trying to make 2%, and then usually the market goes down as a result of us entering the market. And so then that makes our typical margin around 1.5%. So, like, probably a way lower margin than most of our users are getting. I mean, it kind of depends on what kind of deals we're doing. But, like, if spot a break even deal with a Citi Double Cash card, like, you have probably made more money on the deal than we have.
Like, roughly how much volume do you guys typically do, like, per month?
So last year, for the whole year, we did around $20 million. And so that's a little under $2 million a month. And then this year has been better than last year so far, in part because of Pepper, I think. And also we just, in the ideal world, we get a little bit better at what we do every year. So I'd like to think that part of it is, like, that we learned something. But yeah, so, like, around $2 million a month, typically.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know about this whole Pepper thing. It sounds like I really need to get into it. I mean, I've heard of it, but yeah, I guess I didn't realize it was causing such a big effect on the gift card market.
Yeah, it has had a huge effect, for sure. Now, you only get the sign-up bonus when you're, like, a new user, so probably smart to, like, time that well if you're only going to do it once. I have seen some people opening, like, many new accounts, which kind of sounds like something that you would figure out how to do. But
yeah,
something to consider. And I mean, the other, on the flip side, the new user promo can't last forever because they're definitely losing money. So it's like when the venture capital runs out, it'll stop.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like that thing where, like, I didn't get in the early stages of it. So now I'm kind of worried, like, as soon as I figure it out, it'll already be gone. So
yeah.
How do you see, like, gift card resale going, like, in general in the future? Like, I guess, well, yeah, Pepper's probably not going to stay around for too long, but, like, in general...
It's tricky. So year over year, Raise gets slightly worse every year for as long as they've been doing it. And then when I say Raise, I mean, like, all Raise sales. Like, our share of Raise goes up each year, but the pie gets a little bit smaller. I think that a lot of, like, the difference between how we think about the market and how your audience probably thinks about the market is, like, we are always concerned about finding new and more and better places to sell cards. Whereas I think that, like, your audience probably thinks more about, like, new ways to find supply for cards. I don't know. We've just seen so many things come and go that, like, this supply will always be there, basically. Like someone will always have a sale, and there'll be a way to make it work so long as we can find someone to buy it. And so in terms of how like it changes over time, it remains to be seen. But like we continue to like aggressively look for new ways to sell cards. And that's a thing that we're like putting more resources into this year in terms of, you know, trying to go out and find more people that we can directly sell cards to.
Okay. So is Raise mostly just like consumers? Like, is it just like a guy who wants to go buy some shoes from Nike or something and he wants to save like 5%? He'll go buy a card from Raise to use that? Or is it more, is there anyone doing like a higher volume, like buying cards from Raise?
I mean, there's definitely higher volume. I mean, some Home Depot gets sold on Raise, right? Like Home Depot and Lowe's. And so with those, like Home Depot 500s are getting sold, it isn't as much as gets sold privately, but those are probably going to, some of those are going to like contractors, but also it's going to people buying, I mean, a refrigerator can be like $2,000, like more than $2,000 now. You know, if you're going to buy a fridge, you're probably going to buy $500 Home Depot gift cards, right? But Raise is definitely targeted more towards everyday consumers.
Yeah, I get, yeah. So how much of a cut does Raise take?
That is a number that I don't think that I'm allowed to say. Obviously, I've said a bunch of other numbers that are numbers that we possess and that we're allowed to say. It's like they make a lot more money than we do. I mean, I think I can directionally say that their margin, their growth margin is bigger than ours.
So how hard was it to find a banker that was okay with a gift card reselling business that wanted to run $2 million a month through their bank?
We were told no by a lot of banks because it was simply too complicated. Like they didn't, like it wasn't worth their time to figure out how to serve us as a customer because we're not big enough. And so we had to find a small enough bank where we could sit down with, you know, the president and compliance so we could explain all of our anti-money laundering stuff and all that. And then come up with a solution that worked for the bank and worked for us. I mean, that was definitely a long process. I mean, we had to develop an anti-money laundering program that satisfied the bank's attorneys. You know, what we're legally required to do with regard to money laundering is like not much, to be honest, because the regulations don't consider that our type of industry exists at all. You know, the regulations represent the legal minimum of what you have to do, but like we have zero interest in helping anyone launder money. So for us, like we're happy to be as far away from that as possible. And so there's some voluntary things that we have done. For example, like if people sign up on the site, you have to verify your ID through Blue Check. And so Blue Check makes you take like a selfie with your driver's license. And then I think that if it close up with the driver's license, we don't in the ordinary course of business look at those images. We get a thumbs up or a thumbs down from Blue Check in terms of like whether you are who you say you are. So doing that, for example, is like part of the anti-money laundering program. We also require receipts for in-store purchases, and the receipts have to show that you didn't pay with cash. So things like that are things that like the bank requested that we do. And then we get audited by the bank to confirm that we're enforcing the rules, basically.
Okay. And so far, you haven't had any problems with buyers, I guess, just like committing fraud, basically.
I don't think that anyone has ever used this as a vehicle to launder money. We've had, I can think of one instance ever where someone owed us pictures and then didn't give us pictures. That was kind of like the one and only warning. In this case, it was like, it was early in the photo requirements. They didn't understand, whatever. So like, well, this is your one and only pass. Like, you know, if you're going to sell us old cards in the future, you need to have receipts for them. So I remember that happened exactly one time, but I know who that was and I know how they got the cards and I know that it wasn't money laundering, so I'm not worried about it. But yeah, like, as far as we know, that hasn't happened. I mean, we've had people try to sign up for the site with fake IDs and things like that.
Oh, really? How did you know?
Well, so there was a time when we checked the IDs ourselves. And so when I say it was a fake ID, I mean, that gives the ID more credit than it was. It was literally like the Google image result. It was like a sample, like passport photo or something. It wasn't like a sophisticated fake. But now we use Blue Check and they have like their own database. Like I believe they compare to public records and things like that. I don't really know what they do. That's why we pay them to build. It's because we didn't have to figure out how to do any of that. We just embed their software on our site and then they tell us if someone's good to go or not.
Okay. Yeah, that's okay. So it wasn't like someone trying to steal someone's identity. It was just they didn't want to, you know, reveal their identity. And so they just put in a photo, like a fake photo, and hope no one notices.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it would be hard to truly steal someone's identity. I don't know. You need a bank account because we have to pay you, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we're not giving over bags of cash in a parking lot here. It's like, it needs to be on your bank account and stuff.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, like, are you worried about any risks?
Definitely. A little about that all the time. I'm an attorney and I own a business that sells gifts. All I do is worry all day long.
Are your buyers paying you first for the cards?
Well, so like on Raise, we're typically, cards are consigned, right? So we don't get paid until a day after Raise gets paid. And the card has to sell first. And so like there are cards we sell that have been listed for over a year. When you have a certain scale, they play with averages. And so we don't worry about a single card taking a year as long as our cash flow cycle for the month is in good shape. Now, a card taking a year to sell is a problem. I mean, we review old inventory. We don't want our inventory regularly listed for that long, but it's not a huge deal if one card takes that long because it does. For our private buyers, there are definitely buyers that pay us up front. But when they do that, they're paying us up front for inventory that we have on hand that, you know, we're going to deliver. So it all just kind of depends. In a situation, like if a buyer pre-ordered something from us, if they said, like, if you can get us this, I will pay you X and I will buy up to Y amount. When we get a deal like that, we usually take a thinner margin on it just because we know that there's a guaranteed sale coming before we owe the money. And so we're able to accept a much lower margin. There's regularly stuff that we're making half a point or 1 point.
Okay. So you would say like you're worried about the risk of the cards not moving, basically.
I mean, like there's all kinds of risk. I mean, there's like bust out risk of like if one of our users wanted to like try to maliciously defraud us, that is something that we worry about. Yeah, a lot of us still have a lot of hands on the site. And so anytime we see weird stuff, you know, we'll flag it for everyone to look at and then we kind of investigate and decide, you know, what looks normal and what doesn't. So like that is a risk, you know, the risk, like counterparty risk, like what if Raise were to go out of business or something like that. But then also like all the individual brands, right? So like Bed Bath & Beyond went bankrupt a couple of years ago, I think. We never want to be holding too much inventory of any given brand just because, you know, you don't know how that business is doing. You don't want to be holding gift cards that become worthless, things like that. Yeah, I mean, there's a whole laundry list of risks that we worry about all the time. It's a business. I mean, you don't run from risk. You come up with ways to mitigate the risk, right? I mean, there's limits on how much people can upload that like gets automatically approved. And so circuit breaker that goes off if you're reserving too much, that causes us to look more closely at your reservation history and decide what we're doing with that. You know, we try to size our bets appropriately for the businesses that we take like gift cards from. So we try not to be holding more than a month of inventory typically. And our starting point is usually like 2 weeks of inventory. And so that kind of, you know, if a company's going to go bankrupt, like Express announced that they're possibly going bankrupt, you're typically going to have like a couple months before the cards would become worthless. So making sure that our bets stay correctly sized to not get swept by something like that. Obviously, supplier diversity is huge. I mean, we have, you know, hundreds of people, so we're not really worried about being reliant on an individual supplier, but we do worry about buyer diversity. Like there's only so many people that we sell stuff to. You know, that's one of the reasons that we're putting a lot of resources this year into finding, you know, new and additional folks to buy our stuff. Nothing's ever regular. And so, you want as many people as possible so that, again, like, you know, averaged out, it smooths the curve a little bit.
So have you ever considered getting like a line of credit to kind of smooth out the payouts?
Yeah, we're hoping that's something that we can do with our new bank. So the way things work right now is our users kind of supply the credit. So if folks are unfamiliar with how the site looks, like when you make a reservation, standard payout is like 9 to 15 days away. And then you can opt to delay that by like, you know, 2, 4, 6, 8, 16 weeks. And if you opt to delay it, then we pay a higher rate for the stuff. We try to line it up so that the average time for people to get paid lines up with the average time it takes us to get paid. So if, you know, if we're taking on a month and a half of inventory for a brand, then we're going to knock out a couple notches of payment speed, and that will essentially force people to wait longer to get paid if they want to do the deal to keep it in line with when we're going to get paid. In an ideal world, my ideal would be never forcing the user to do anything. The ideal would be that you always have every payout speed available and just borrow the money from the bank. It's something that we're working on, and we'll see what we can do. But we're going to be trying to get a line of credit, and that's what we would use in the event that our users didn't want to delay their payouts sufficiently.
Okay, yeah. So I guess with all this risk and stuff, do you still get the time to like travel and vacation? Like, can you ever take a break from your business?
Yeah, well, yes and no. The best part of the job is that it can be done from anywhere. I have probably never gone more than 2 days in a row without doing any work for the site. And more often than not, I do work 7 days a week, but I'm not usually working 8 hours a day, and I can usually pick whatever hours I want. So if I'm in Europe, I can wake up in the morning. It's a little after midnight in the US on the East Coast, and that's when all the deals are posting. So I can like do my work in the morning. Yeah, I mean, I still get to travel a lot. I was in Europe all last month, and so we go on plenty of trips. I mean, that's like why I did this. And if I stopped being able to travel, I would probably just get a regular job again, because that's what makes it fun, right?
Do you ever feel like you miss being able to fully disconnect? Because once I started to take my training more seriously, it just became really hard, especially during the holidays and stuff when I'm trying to take a Christmas vacation or something. I tried to just turn everything off, but it didn't really work for me. Because I always get that fear of missing out. And if you're doing stuff online, it doesn't really take that long to hit those deals. So yeah, how do you feel about that?
I have a lot of empathy for you, especially around like Black Friday. And, like, this is something that's taken a few years for me to get over. But I don't know, I would feel like guilty almost, like knowing that there's like a great HEB deal and that the stores are going to be up until 8. And like, I went home for dinner at 6 and then I didn't want to go back out again. And there was definitely a time when I would sit on the couch and feel guilty about it. You know, I'm constantly in pursuit of a greater state of Zen. And part of that is being happy with the 6 hours of work that you put in or whatever, and being able to take some time off so that you don't get totally burnt out. What's your approach to that? It sounds like you maybe haven't not quite achieved Zen yet.
Yeah, well, I think it's maybe just planning trips around the holidays. It's just not a good time. That could just be the answer.
I don't know. We plan our travel kind of around the retail calendar. So I try not to book any trips for all of November. I mean, we go see my wife's family for Thanksgiving. However, I actually work all day on Thanksgiving because Dollar General always has a sale on Lowe's. Thanksgiving is in rural Texas. And so we hit the road at like 7 a.m. And the what should be a 4-hour drive takes like 8 or 9 hours because I stop at every Dollar General along the way. They come up every 5 or 10 minutes. So Thanksgiving Day ends up being super busy, but thankfully that sale only lasts one day. And so then I get to enjoy some peace on the way home the next day. But, and then like, you know, Christmas and my father-in-law's birthday is like Christmas Eve. And then we always go to see my family for Christmas. Fortunately, the deals have usually slowed by actual Christmas. And so then it's not so hard to disconnect. And I'm usually exhausted anyway. So it's like, I don't know, I've kind of run the marathon and so I'm ready to take a break at that point. And so then it's not so hard for me to disconnect a bit.
I feel like sometimes there is a little bit of a relief when a deal goes out of stock, because then I don't have to worry about missing out on it anymore.
Yeah, I know that feeling a lot. Yeah, there was a deal that got cut short last Thanksgiving, I think, maybe 2 Thanksgivings ago. There was a coupon that probably was not supposed to be unlimited, that was unlimited for Home Depot. And it was just like printing money. I mean, it was basically like every Home Depot that I went to, I was making $200, or every HEB I went to, I was making $200. So it's like, how could you possibly justify not going all day long? And then after 2 days, when they killed the deal, I was just like, thank God it's over. The free money was nice, but also like it was just really hard to go as hard as possible multiple days in a row.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess maybe just for a few more minutes, if you want to just talk about any like travel plans that you have, or maybe what was like your favorite trip in the past year or so.
Definitely one of my favorite trip. I got to go to Richard Branson's island, Necker Island. I think it was like 2 million Virgin points. And one of my business partners went as well. He proposed to his now fiance there. That was in the fall. And yeah, I mean, that was just absolutely incredible. There were like 14 people on the island total, like guests, everything was included, and it was just like absolutely paradise. That was very cool.
Yeah, I guess I've never even heard about this. So can you just tell me a little more about this this deal? So you said you booked with Virgin Points?
Yeah, so I think it was either 1.75 million or 2 million, or possibly the price is 2.2 million now. I don't know. It's just an astronomical number of points. So I transferred most of mine with a 30% bonus from Citi in like 2019. And I did it because there was availability coming up and there was the transfer bonus. So I did that. And then you also, at the time, you had to have Virgin Silver status to do it. If you make a map of like how far you have to fly to get Virgin Silver from Austin, where I am, Lima, Peru is like just over the line where you could get Virgin Silver status from a paid business class flight. And so my wife and I went to Lima for a long weekend. And like Lima was incredible on its own. But the purpose was mostly just to get Virgin status, which we got. And then we were just waiting for them to release the next, they call them celebration weeks, because normally you can only rent the whole island out. But there's a few weeks a year where you can rent individual rooms. And so it has to be one of those weeks for you to use points. So we were waiting for one of those to be released. And then that was early 2020. And then, you know, a few things happened. And we weren't able to do it until the end of 2023. I would email every 6 months and ask if they had space open yet. And then finally they did last year.
2 million points.
Yeah, let's say 2 million plus or minus a quarter million. And they no longer require that you have Virgin status.
Okay. So it's 2 million points for a 1 week trip, a room on the island, is what you're saying.
The island consists of, I think, four different houses, they call them. And so you're in the Great House, which is the largest house and like on top of a hill. And each of the houses has its own bar and its own pool. And so like some nights, like dinner will be served at the Great House. Some nights it'll be served at Bali High. Some nights it'll be at Bali Low. So like they just move events around. So like, it doesn't really matter which house you're in. Like sometimes things will be happening, you know, in the building that you're in, and sometimes it won't. The Great House, I think, has six rooms, maybe six or eight rooms. The other houses have four, I think. It's a really wild experience, though. It's like truly all inclusive. They encourage you, like, if there's not a bartender at your bar, you can call and they'll send a bartender, but you're also allowed to just like go behind the bar and take whatever you want. So we snuck home a couple bottles of nectar champagne. Yeah, like water sports are all included. So I got to learn how to e-foil, which is pretty neat. Didn't even know what it was before I got there. There's like sailboat races. It's just like, it's paradise. It's like you can do whatever you want. And there's just a whole staff of people there to help you do it.
Wow. And is this deal still available? It's still available?
Yeah. So they're constantly tweaking the terms of what it is. And I'm not looking to book it again just yet. So I'm not super up to date on what the rules are. They had briefly changed it, I think, to where you had to book at least four nights, and that was like a certain price, and then you could add on additional nights. And it was like, that was a slightly worse deal, depending on how many nights you wanted. But then I also thought I saw recently that they switched back to having it be for a full weekend, and I think it was either 2 million or 2.2 million. They also limit the number of people who can do it per year. So one of our other business partners was considering doing it, and then by the time that he finally committed, they were out of all 10 seats had been booked, basically.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely don't want to be transferring 2 million points and then not be able to book points.
Well, yeah, I mean, imagine how I felt having moved off this points in 2019. And then, like, you know, every time there's an article that's like, you know, Necker Island on the verge of, or not Necker Island, but like Virgin, you know, teetering on bankruptcy and like getting loans and stuff, it was all like, I just wasted $20,000 worth of points, basically, right? So yeah, I lived in fear for a long time.
Well, yeah, that definitely sounds stressful.
Yeah, I'm looking at the site right now, and the Google preview, it says 2 million for a 1 week stay. So
yeah, that doesn't seem like that bad of a deal. I mean, that seems like, I mean, if you think about that kind of vacation would cost in cash, it would probably be, you know, at least double that, probably.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think that if you were to pay cash, it would be like 35 to 40. Yeah, it's a good deal, technically. Also, it kind of shows what this hobby does to you, right? I mean, hobby, business, industry. I mean, I would imagine that you've been staring at 2 million points, but like, that just sounds like a completely insurmountable made up number when I first heard about it many years ago. And I just wrote it off as like, well, I how could you ever have 2 million points? But yeah, I mean, if you're reselling stuff, it's really not unobtainable to have that many points.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely different world now than, I mean, when I first started, it was like 100,000 point business platinum offer was like amazing. I was, you know, I was kind of thinking in the hundreds of thousands.
And now if it's not 250,000, like, don't even wake me up.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah.
Or if you can find a way to spend $500,000 on Pepper without even a sign-up bonus, then you're in, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I got to get into Pepper, I think.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's like the hottest thing right now. So like a couple years ago, there's an app called Slide that was kind of doing a similar thing. Like it was 5% off everything and you could go through cashback portals to get another 4 or 5% off. And that was, they were losing money on that. And that was like funded by venture capital or whatever. And so anytime somebody wants to lose money selling gift cards, like I am happy to set up the infrastructure to take them up on that deal.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I've been thinking about using Best Buy gift cards to buy stuff. I'm just not sure, you know, it's just, it would be a lot more work because, you know, so many orders get canceled and then you have to figure out which cards still have money on them. And then,
yeah.
And then if something goes wrong, there's no, you can't charge back. There's no recourse
for sure. Yeah. You have to like weigh those options. And I mean, since you buy so much actual stuff, I feel like at a minimum, it seems like you ought to get Pepper just to use the gift cards for yourself. Cause there's all that hassle, but I mean, you're getting an extra 10%. I mean, that's like significant in your case, right?
Yeah. It would be an extra 10%. But I guess the 10% would come in like Pepper coins or whatever. So
right, but you can spend those coins on more Best Buy gift cards. So I mean, it was yeah. You can call it 91.1 if you prefer. So you're getting 8.9% additional squeeze.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure I should probably could find a way to liquidate the card.
I mean, I don't know. It feels like a juicy enough deal. I don't know. It seems like you got to be able to find a way to make it work. I believe in you.
Okay. Yeah, I think we kind of ran through all the questions that I had. Unless there's anything else you wanted to talk about.
Do you have some upcoming travel that you're excited about?
Well, we've got a few different trips that are spread out across the year. I think we're mainly looking forward to going to Morocco in November.
So, November travel, that's a mistake. You gotta, you're not fully committed to the churning life, despite being with a podcast.
No, I'm not. It's, you know.
That's a rookie mistake. I was still making that mistake up until 2 years ago. I would know, knowing full well that I was going to think I was an idiot when I did it. And then I went to Thailand for 2 months in 2022 and never again.
But it's like, I gotta optimize, you know, my company holidays and stuff. And
how close are you to going full time reselling? To be honest, I thought you already did.
I mean, reselling just doesn't feel stable enough for me. It feels like something that I can continue doing on the side. Like it doesn't really require that much of my time. My wife still has a job, so it wouldn't be like we could just, you know, travel whenever we wanted. The job that I have, it's good enough to where, you know, I can work from home a lot of days. I think it's more just to do with the job that I have is really good for being able to churn and stuff on the side. If I was in like a job where I had to be on site doing physical work for 8 hours a day, then I would definitely consider quitting that.
So, I mean, what did it for me was we had to start going back to the office after COVID, and then they kept upping the amount of time we had to be in the office. You know, when I'm in the office, I'm not running the site. And so, I mean, it was costing me money. I mean, it was like, I couldn't post deals until I got home from work and things like that. So there's a real price to that. For me, there came a point where it was like, we make enough money. Like, it's not my aspiration to be like incredibly wealthy. The only way that I'll ever get to go to Necker Island is on points, right? But I think it's important for you to know, and you may already know, how much is enough for you. Because if you don't know what enough is, then you can never have enough. And I would say like the biggest positive change that I've ever had in my life was quitting my day job and doing this full time. Like I'm just so immensely more satisfied every day. I enjoy what I do. I'm excited to start working in the morning and doing this. And maybe you get all of that from your day job. And I hope that you do. But if you don't, I hope that you really do consider, if you ever decide that it works for your family and that it's stable enough and whatever, I hope that you don't let an okay job prevent you from having the best job.
Yeah. I guess how old are you and how long were you working your job before you made that decision?
So I'm going to turn 33 this year, and I was at that job for 5 years, roughly. But I mean, I had been full-time an attorney since I was 22, I think, 23.
Being an attorney is, well, how much work was it?
Well, I worked for government, so it wasn't too bad because it was like, you know, strictly 9 to 5, but also the pay wasn't that good. You know, I had really good vacation benefits and like I could take a day off work and go buy HEB or whatever. And because I just got an obscene amount of vacation. But the difference between that and not having to worry about it at all was like really, really big. I just know too many people, and myself included, who had a good enough thing and like let that hold them back from a great thing, you know, just something to think about. And then maybe the answer is not this year, because someone had a similar conversation that I'm having with you right now about a year before I quit. And I'm glad that they had that conversation, because quitting was awesome. I mean, it was the best decision I ever made.
Yeah. I guess one thing I'd be worried is like, you know, one day Amex could just shut down all of our accounts. And well, I guess you probably also have to worry about, you know, something could happen to your business as well. But I guess,
yeah, I mean, of course, something back. I mean, you could also, your company could lay you off. I mean, your company could go bankrupt. And unless you work for the federal government, then you're probably okay. But like other than that, like all these bad things can happen for any job, whether you're your boss or whether someone else is your boss. And you can always get a new job.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah. Well, yeah, I definitely appreciate the insight on that. Yeah, thanks a lot for joining. Yeah, so yeah, we should keep in touch. I don't know, do you go to any meetups for any of the groups or the like Chicago seminar thing or whatever?
We've done Chicago seminars the last couple of years. I don't know that we're going to do it this year. It kind of depends. I'm going to be at the Award Travel 101 meetup in San Antonio in 2 or 3 weeks at the end of April. It's at Fiesta San Antonio. So I'll be at that. And actually something that we're trying to work on more this year is in lieu of going to Chicago seminars type stuff is going to more like local meetups around the country. So hopefully I'll make it out to the West Coast at some point.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, thanks again for coming on, and let's try and keep in touch.
Yeah, sounds good. Have a good one, man.
Okay. Yeah. So that's the episode. If you want to reach out to Logan, he is on the Churning Life Slack, and he's also, of course, very active in the Align Incentives Telegram. Hope you guys enjoy this discussion. I'm hoping to do a few more of these like this. So stay tuned, and until next time.